now we're going to start a little bit in on the history again of, I say history of insect systematics, but some of this pertains to just systematics in general, but some of it is pertinent, more pertinent just to the insects too. And I, again, I always chuckle when I start with this, because I've start these notes. I mean, I took the class and helped teach it a couple of places, but some of this is actually came from my predecessor here. Dr. Balsball was the taxonomist here before I came, and he left his notes, and so I used some of his stuff to help me get started. Actually, that's who Jerry worked for before I got here. So he was Dr. Balsball's student, but he actually had brain cancer, got a tumor and that. But anyway, I always chuckle because Dr. Balsball started with the caveman. Can't go much farther back than that. But then actually, the notes you'll see, it says we're going to start at the caveman, but probably people or animals even before them learned to distinguish what's a bad animal and what's a good animal. This one might eat me, this one won't eat me. Well, that's a basic taxonomy. They learn to recognize different kinds and which ones might be harmful and which ones not. Learning to distinguish and start categorizing is an ancient basic taxonomy. So even primitive peoples were very surprisingly good at distinguishing different forms and different types of animals. We can, of course, we don't have a lot of data. It goes back to caveman times and stuff. We can tell some from their pictures they drew and stuff. But we can look at primitive people today, and it gives us some idea of what they might have been like way back. And again, in your notes, there's an example from New Guinea, a tribal group in the mountains of New Guinea that haven't been around civilization, and they had names for all the different kinds of birds. And the example that I've got says that there's like 138 species of birds in their region, and they had names for 137 of them. There was only one that they confused with something else. So even if they're not trained in taxonomy, that people can be pretty good at distinguishing how different things are. In truth, the classification and taxonomy has its roots in the ancient Greece, the ancient Greeks. Plato and especially Aristotle began to have writings and would talk about different types of animals and different groups of animals. Aristotle referred to such major groups as the birds, the fishes, whales, and insects. And he had names for some lesser groups. For example, he's coined the Coleoptera for beetles and Diptera for flies. As we'll see later, and hear it a little bit, he doesn't get credit for this in modern day like maybe he should, but he's one who coined some of this stuff. The Greeks kind of were in what we called a teleological school of thought. And what that kind of was is that they believed that nature didn't waste energy on aberrant type things. I don't know. It was kind of like they viewed for each species there was the one perfect example, and all the other individuals were just imperfect variations on that one perfect model. And it's not that important now, although it led them astray sometimes in some of their thoughts at that time, but it kind of is the basis for a typological type thoughts that still persist today. And there's still good reason. When we'll get to it in a future lecture, but you know, when I describe a new species, and I may have 10 or 15 specimens of this new species, mm-hmm. I've got to pick one of those to represent the species. And we call that the holotype, or it's the type for the species. It's still a good practice to do, to nail down the name with that group. But there were people that would only describe that one specimen and not recognize the variation and stuff. And that's where this typological thought came clear back from Greek and Aristotle. So,
question: how do you, so in that particular instance where you have 10 to 15 species of specimens of a new species, how do you choose the whole time?
The good question. We'll get to that probably in another lecture. But there's all kinds of things that may go into it. Some are good. Some may be political even. Ideally, that new species has some characteristics that make it different from everything else. And you often pick a type that illustrates those characteristics the best. So it definitely defines your species. In most cases, that has something to do with the genitalia. The reproductive parts are the most distinctive, and usually it's in the males. So most times, for most insects anyway, we try to pick a male in the best condition where you can see the characteristics you need to see. Condition comes into it. You'd rather have a nice, good specimen rather than one that's beat up or got things missing. Where I say politics sometimes comes into it, if you go collecting in a lot of foreign countries right now, they will stipulate before you can get a permit to collect in their country that if you describe a new species from material that you got out of their country, the type specimen has to be put back into a museum in their country. They don't want it to be in a museum from like up here in the U.S. And that's probably okay. It's got good reasoning behind it, but a lot of those countries, say in Central and South America, the museums don't take care of their specimens. And so you really are sometimes hesitant about putting a type down there. So you may have 10 or 15 specimens, 10 of which you collected down there, but you might have 5 more that were already collected a long time ago that belong to, say, a museum up here in the U.S. And so even if these 5 aren't as good a condition as those 10, you might pick one of these just so you can put it in a museum that's, you know, is going to be well taken care of, rather than picking a good one here, but it goes down to some country in South America and 2 years later the museum burns down. Which happened. Again, I think there was some politics involved maybe, but the big national collection in Brazil just burned down a year or two ago. Lost millions and millions of specimens, including thousands of types. So anyway, again, when we get to classifications, I talk a good bit more about types and that. So we'll get back to that a little bit. But that's some of the things that go into it. You want to pick a specimen that you can see the character's good. Usually it ends up being a male specimen. And you want the condition to be good. But sometimes the thought of where you end up going to deposit the specimen plays a role too on what specimen you pick. So a lot of people in the past would tend to pick specimens from their own collection because they wanted types in their own collection. It makes their collection more valuable. See, I don't do that. I have picked types that come from my collection, but I don't keep them. I send them to the USNM or the American Museum or some major museum where they'll be well taken care of and be accessible to whoever else might want to look at them and stuff. So, so anyway, Aristotle, he did have a little brief classification of the insects, and he based it first on winged. He talked whether they were winged or wingless, and then if they were winged, if they had elytra or not elytra, and if they had without elytra, whether they had 4 wings or 2 wings, separate.
So did he accept elytra as actual wings, or did he just...
He recognized them. Well, he didn't... Yeah, I guess he didn't... It's just whether they had hard front wings or not hard front wings, and then if they didn't have hard front wings, then it was whether they only had 2 wings or if they had 4 wings.
Okay.
So... And then within that, he did look at their mouth parts and their feeding habits. You can probably see there whether they had he called them teeth, but it's the mandibles, or whether they had a beak like mouth part and proboscis, and then what they fed on. So, and with only a few modifications, this what he did actually served students of science for many years, thousands of years, in through the Middle Ages. So my notes say it served science at the level they were at for 2,000 years. So, but that gets us into the Middle Ages, and the Middle Ages were interesting in that they published books. They were called bestiaries. Is that there in your notes? You can say a lot of this. Since you've got all the notes, it saves me a little time, because I'm usually up here writing all these words on the board too. But you've got them there in front of you. Bestiaries. And the way to describe what a bestiary was, it was kind of like a naturalist scrapbook that somebody would be working like on flower color and say, well, these are red and these are blue, and but if I let them cross-pollinate, the next one's still some are red and some are blue, but there might be some intermediates. And but they'll write their notes down, and the next generation will read those and say, well, that's interesting. I'm going to do a little bit more and try these colors or this. And so they'll just add to it. And so it wasn't like, you know, here's a book. It's almost like different editions, but it was just like a natural scrapbook. People that would just keep adding more and more on to each one every time it got printed or released. And so... so anyway, they also, in that time period, they believed in spontaneous generation, which, of course, you've probably had that in other biology classes and that.
The mouse coming from, was it the mouse? I think it was the mouse just coming from a thing of cheese or...
well, they thought flies were coming...
from rice.
From meat or something. Meat. And, but they did an experiment where they put meat in a closed container and no flies would come out of it, and it, you had a meat in an open container, they could show that the flies came in and laid eggs, and then you got new flies out. So but then we're starting to get up into the 1500s, into the early 1600s. There's a guy named Aldrovandi, and he published a big book called De Animalibus Insectis Libre the Seven, which was the first work of literature dealing with insects. This actually is kind of what established entomology as a discipline, and also and specifically systematic entomology as a science. His classification of insects kind of broke it down on where they lived. Its first separation is whether they lived on land or if they lived in the water. And again, that's not showing much on relationship. Aristotle's stuff kind of got at relationship a little bit, but this just had all the land insects together and all the aquatic insects together. And then further breakdowns were based on wing and leg morphology. You'll see in the notes there was a guy named Swammerdam. He was a Dutchman in the mid-1600s. He published a classification of insects based on their metamorphosis, a little bit more on how they developed, which is kind of how we do it now today. We were talking about that in the field yesterday a little bit, but you know, basically, and again, this is you know what I'd hope you might remember from introductory entomology, but there's at the lower end we have things like Protura and Calembula and things we call ametamorphosis. They don't really have much change. The young immatures look exactly like the adults. They're just a little bit smaller than the adults, but they're not winged. They're the Aterogota, so they're not winged. And so essentially the immatures and the adults look very similar to each other, just size. They go through different molts, and then you get to the reproductively mature groups. So that's ametamorphosis. There's essentially no metamorphosis. Then there's the ones like the stink bugs and grasshoppers and things that we talked about yesterday, that the immatures look like the adults, except the adults have wings. And you can actually see the wing development each different instar of the young as they get closer and closer to the adults. There's wing pads that get a little bit bigger. And that we call gradual metamorphosis or hemimetabolus. And we actually can split that into, there's some aquatic groups that, where the immatures and the adults don't look quite the same. Like dragonfly immatures don't look like the adults. So it's a little bit of a subset, but it's still hemimetabolus. Okay, that's what I thought. What time is it?
8:38, 9:38, 22.
That was just my son telling me he's dropping the dog off now. So now I got to calculate 3 or 4 hours from now that I have to be home. But then the more advanced groups are what we call the holometabolists or complete metamorphosis. And they have an egg stage, they have the immature stage, they have a resting stage, the pupa or chrysalis, and then they have the adult stage. And so that's what Swammerdam, he kind of based his classification on those different groups that we still kind of recognize today. There's some others listed in there that aren't real. It's important that Vallis Neri, again, he did it on where they lived a little bit. But we're starting to creep up onto the real important people. You know, we're getting to Linnaeus, and we give Linnaeus a lot of credit for coming up with binomial nomenclature and a lot of different things. But he didn't come up with all this stuff on his own. He was influenced by a number of people before him. And one of the people that had the greatest influence on Linnaeus was a guy named John Ray. You can see the time period. He was from 1628 to 1705. But it was clear that John Ray had a concept of what a species was and what a genus was. He didn't name the categories and didn't get into binomial classification, but he talked about species, or the species concept. He talked about things that were offspring from the same parents or from identical parents. So he was recognizing, cows look different than horses, and they reproduce, and their offspring look like cows, and these look like horses. But he also had a concept of what genera were. He said that there were groups of species which resemble each other. So there might be a bunch of different kinds of horses, and all these look like one, these all look like, but all these horses look more like each other than cows look like horses. So he kind of was given credit for developing this species and genera or genus concept, which is what Linnaeus then grabbed onto, and we give Linnaeus a lot of credit. And Linnaeus deserves a lot of credit. At that time, to give you an idea of what was going on a little bit on naming things, at that time, people tried to use the name, and we still do a little bit today, but to not only be the name of the organism, but also to describe the organism. And so, like, if you had a fly, they might call it just Musca. Name it Musca, species of fly. And then somebody comes along and says, well, there's more than one species of fly.
All this species of fly.
Here's one that's brown and here's one that's green. The brown one, we'll call it Musca fusca. It's the Latin name for brown. And the other one, we'll call it Musca viridis. That's green. Okay, well, that looks good. Well, then somebody else says, well, there's another one that's small and these are big ones. So then if these are big ones, they'd say, well, okay, that's like add on magna to both of these. And the other one would be now Musca parva. Just on and on. Every time somebody would come up with a new species, they'd just add more names on until this name would be a paragraph long. And you'd have to change it. It'd be changing every time somebody else came with a new. So it was just real chaotic. And so
I was going to say, I'd like to see Alex do some of those names.
Yeah. So Linnaeus, and I always say it this way, he didn't get it right off. The famous book that Linnaeus did is called Systema Naturae. That's the beginning of systematics as we know it today. The thing is, the one that we have adopted as the starting point is the 10th edition. Meaning he went through 9 editions before we thought it was the way we wanted it. And it actually went through, I think for him, at least 2 or 3 editions after the 10th. And then other scientists published books that they called like the 13th and 14th editions of it. But in Systema Naturae, in the 10th edition, and this was 1758, is when that came out. And so this is where modern systematics starts. And this is where I was said earlier, where Aristotle no longer gets credit. We've decided to use this as the starting date. And so we don't search literature
beyond that
earlier than this date. And so, like, we still use the Coleoptera. We give Linnaeus credit. Anything that was happened before this, Linnaeus gets credit for it. I mean, he used it, if he used it. If he didn't use it, then whoever first used it after that date. Somehow, sometimes it doesn't seem quite right, but still, it saves me from having to search all the way back to the who knows when for literature too. Although just for fun, I still sometimes I've got copies of things that are older than 1758. And one of the projects I'm working on is a catalog of the stink bugs of the world. And I go back all those literature. And actually I've included some things that are older than 1758 just for informational purpose so people can see some few things that are older. So, but in this edition is when he first started, got the concept of binomial nomenclature down good. That's where now the name is a scientific name for a species or anything. It consists of 2 names, binomial, right? You're going to have the genus name and then the species name. And so that's what we go by today. He wasn't adopted by everybody right away. There's a work in my group from 1845 who claimed he didn't think we had to have both names. He wanted everything just by one name. He thought we could just call everything by one name. And that's called mononomial nomenclature, of course. And any works that use mononomial nomenclature have all been officially rejected now, so they're not used. Again, I've got a copy of the paper, and I've included some of the stuff that he did in my catalog, again, just so people can see what he did and have that information. But anyway, Linnaeus, as I already mentioned, part of that binomial nomenclature, it separated the name from the description. Now you would have a name, it's 2 words, the genus and species, and it's separate from the description. You have that separate. And so now when you added new things, the name didn't change. As we'll see later, the other things changed names, but in general concept now, the name was more permanent and the description was separate. This gained fairly quick, widespread approval. It got rid of a lot of the chaos. He also wrote in Latin, which was the scientific language of the day, so a lot of different people could understand it. He also is given credit for what we call developing this hierarchical classification. And you know what I mean by hierarchical classification?
Yeah, in terms of
it models, like
it's
the obligate categories.
Yeah, I'm going to talk about those in just a second. But it's basically, yeah, you've got species that all look together, are grouped together in a genus, genera that all seem to be related, grouped into a family, families that all look, and so on, go up the line, you know. So it's just ever bigger, but that's called hierarchical classification. Linnaeus used the he had class, order, genus, and species. The categories that, let's see. Linnaeus utilized the following categories: class, order, genus, species, and sometimes variety, which is a whole different ballgame. Also, Linnaeus used as his primary character for his classification was wings. So wings were paramount for Linnaeus. That's why most of our order names today are named for their wings. Lepidoptera are scale wings. I mean, the P-T-E-R-A ending literally means wings. So anything that has P-T-E-R-A after it is set something wings. Coleoptera are sheath wings. Hemiptera are half wings.
I think I remember there was a, I can't remember what it was, but it ended with Aptera, which means no.
That's the Aptera, yeah, which one is it? Oh, the Siphonaptera is one of them. Mm-hmm. Siphonaptera ends in A-P-T-E-R-A. A means no or without. And so it's literally the siphon animals without wings. So, in the original edition, he recognized four orders: Coleoptera. There's one he called the Angioptera, which we now call Hymenoptera, the Hemiptera, and then the Aptera. That was in 1735. In each different edition, he added a few more orders and stuff. There were some people that disagreed with what he did. A German guy named Klein said we should only use external characters for classifying animals, and he was opposed to using teeth because it was too dangerous to look in their mouths. You might get bitten by something. So, if we just go a little bit longer, we may finish this and then we'll be in good shape. Linnaeus was an important guy and described, what do my notes say? He described like I got it in there. 2,000. Yeah, 2,000 species of insects. But Fabricius is the next one we'll talk about. Fabricius was a student of Linnaeus's. He actually studied with Linnaeus, and he was very prolific. He described something like 10,000. I got a copy. I forgot about that. Systema Naturae. I've got a copy of the. It's not an original from way back then, but it's a facsimile. It's been republished. But I could show you what the descriptions look like. Anyway, Fabricius was strongly influenced by Linnaeus. He was called the foremost taxonomist or entomologist of the 18th century. Described over 10,000 species. One of the problems he did, though, is he emphasized mouth parts more important than the wings. And so he actually renamed a lot of the order names that Linnaeus had established.
So I'm guessing Ada or Oda is meaning mouth?
Yeah, like Ringoda is kind of, Rin is beak. So like the Hemiptera became Ringoda, Pisata for Hymenoptera, Eleuthera for Coleoptera. Glossata probably refers to that siphoning thing for the Lepidoptera. And which is kind of strange because that is one of the things Linnaeus' thing was supposed to do, is keep people from renaming stuff. But as we'll see, the things were still a little bit chaotic back then. But anyway, he renamed a lot of Linnaeus's orders. And of course, that doesn't follow our rules, so we don't use Fabricius's names. We still use Linnaeus's names. Mm-hmm. There's, again, it's in the notes, you probably already know the answer, but there is at least one order that Fabricius named based on teeth that we still use. Do you know which one it is? Odonata. Odonata, yeah. The Odonata, the Odonates, their dentures and stuff. So it's the one that still persists. Latreille is the next one on my list. And he overlapped with Fabricius a little bit, but he combined the best of the classifications of Linnaeus and Fabricius to form a more natural classification. He added in the category family in here. And again, just as a side note, there's a guy named Haeckel in 1886 added phylum up here. And I don't have in my notes who or when the upper one that we had was added, kingdom. And actually now I don't even know, do they still use kingdoms? We've gone to those, I think they called them domains, yeah. So, but anyway, the point I'm making here, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and this is what we call the obligate categories. What you mentioned earlier. Every animal will have a name in each one of these categories. Animalia, anyway, they'll have the name in every one of these. Now, there's a lot of other categories now we have today. You might have subspecies, might have subfamilies, there's superfamilies up and above and below, and there's subgenera. So there's a lot more categories, but each organism is not required to have a name in all those others, but they'll have a category in all of those, what we call obligate. So, and then the last thing that I want to just briefly touch on is, again, I said things were still a little bit chaotic at this point in time. Communication wasn't great. Some of the things like the Napoleonic Wars made it tough for literature to get from different European countries and stuff. And so if you lived in England and traveled, say, to Germany, a lot of the species were the same. You could recognize the different species, but the Germans may have all different names than the English did, and so you couldn't recognize the names. And there was still not a very good set of rules governing things. Like, if you name something Musca Fusca because it's brown, maybe it's only brown because it turns brown after it dies. Somebody else came along and says, well, this thing's not really brown. When these things are alive, they're green. And so they just changed the name. It says, Fusca is not a good name. We're going to call it Viridis from now on. Well, the rules now that we have, you can't do that. If you just don't like a name, you can't change it. So, but that's what I'm getting to. You know, even though Linnaeus did a good thing getting us this binomial nomenclature and the hierarchical classification and giving us the basis, people were still doing quite chaotic things. And so that's by the time we get to close to 1900, the late 1800s and 1900, systematists started getting together better and talking about this and said, we got to develop some rules and guidelines to go by. And so they actually have published what are called the International Codes of Nomenclature. And different editions have come out like every 10 or 20 years. I think the last one we've got maybe is around 2000. And they'll get some amendments or changes along the way. But now we do have, and I should have brought it in here, but I've got a book, but it's all, the newest one's actually online. You can go and read any rule. And I do every once in a while. I'm like, man, how do I handle this situation? And I'll call up the code and read what they say I should do about it and stuff. And again, we'll talk more about that as we go through the classification lectures on species, genera, families, and if there's conflicts or what synonyms and homonyms and all that stuff. We'll talk more about that. the point here was the history part, was that we got to a point where we knew we needed rules and guidelines, and so we actually did. And for the last century or a little more, we've had books at least to go by. There's no taxonomy police out there. It's done with peer pressure and that, whether we accept things and that. But if you don't describe a species in the right way, nobody's going to throw you in jail or anything. They just won't accept your work. So, so that should take care of the history part. Do you guys have any questions before we quit for today? And again, anytime you have questions, usually I start each lecture with, do you have questions from the previous stuff? So,
I guess I have a question. How does taxa fit into all of this?
A taxa is a kind of a general term. These are the taxonomic categories or the names. Taxa is more of a general thing. It's really kind of hard to... I should look that up and be able to give you a good definition. But it's, if I don't know whether this thing's a species or a subspecies, sometimes I'll just call it, well, this taxa or this taxon, and talk about it in more general terms. Or even at the generic level, you can say that, you know, this genus, but you can say the taxa in this genus or something. It's kind of a more nebulous thing, but I'll try to do that. I'll try to look up what a specific definition of it is and see if we can that. So, sometimes I worry. I mean, this has been okay. In classification, I got to keep telling myself that, you know, this is what I do and it's second nature to me, and I may talk about some things in a way that is hard for you guys to understand if you've never done taxonomy and that. And so that's the trouble sometimes. If you know it too well, you don't realize that some people might, I mean, like the taxa, I don't know with off the top of my head what the exact definition is. I just know how I use the term and how it's differently used than those. But it's just something I do.